Support for this program comes from Jazz on the Tube, the Internet's largest collection of free streamable classic jazz videos. From Miles Davis to Louis Armstrong, from Thelonious Monk to Duke Ellington, you'll find it all on jazzonthetube.com. Start your free subscription today.
Hi, and welcome to Jazz Talk, a Jazz on the Tube podcast. My name is Ken McCarthy, and this is where we talk with people who are doing important work that supports and illuminates the music we love. The writers, the scholars, the educators, the filmmakers, the producers, and more. And today we're talking with a guest who I am really thrilled to be talking with. Some people will remember our interviews with Dave Oliphant, the great jazz scholar who taught us about the importance of Texas and Texans in the development of jazz. If you didn't hear those interviews, make sure you listen to them. We really can't understand jazz and its history until we understand Texas. And one of the people that Dave pointed out to me that I've been studying a lot now, so important, is a artist named Eddie Durham. And artist is only one of the things that we can use to describe him. He was an inventor. I understand he was a great carpenter. He was an instrumentalist. He was a composer. He was an arranger. He was also a developer of methods to play musical instruments. I mean, when we get into this man's biography, you're not even going to believe all the things that he's done. I think easily he's one of the most important people in jazz history. I would go so far as to say one of the most important people in all of American music history. And I'm going to say, when we hear his full story, this is one great American. I mean, he is one of the best representatives of what makes America a great place out there. And we are privileged to be speaking with his daughter, Topsy Durham. Welcome, Topsy.
Oh, hello. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm pretty good today. Going on pretty well.
Good. And you're taking up the important task of documenting your father's career and work. And, you know, in this world of music, you know, music unfortunately is a subset of show business. And, you know, show business has its pluses and its minuses. And one of the minuses of show business is sometimes people who are incredibly important contributors aren't as well known as some other people. And that's clearly the case in Mr. Durham's situation. And when our fans and everybody, Topsy, just so you know this, everybody listening to this podcast is a serious jazz fan. I mean serious with a capital S. And when they hear the details of what your father contributed to this music, I want everyone to go out and shout it from the rooftops, because this is... You know why? It's a missing piece of our history. I feel this has to be in the consciousness of every jazz fan. That's my goal. And we're going to get the ball rolling on that today. So where to begin? Why don't we start with the birth? You know?
Yeah, okay.
And should we call him Eddie? Should we call him Mr. Durham? What's the best way?
Call him Eddie. Well, he's actually Eddie Durham Sr. because he had a son that he named Eddie Durham Jr. But
okay.
They're both passed now. So, but he's Eddie Durham Sr. Eddie is fine.
Okay, great. So when we're going to talk about Eddie, and so Eddie was born in a little town in Texas. Can you tell us a little bit about that place, where it is, and the size of it, and so on?
Yeah. So San Marcos in Texas. It's in between San Antonio and Austin. You can land in either airport and drive about an hour to San Marcos. It's the largest population there is Texas State University, with about 40,000 students, last I heard, where they have an annual Eddie Durham Festival in February. And I think it's actually a whole month long every year, but they've only been doing it about 4 or 5 years. And it's the Southwest in Texas. It's a small town.
Now, when Eddie lived there, there definitely wasn't the University of Texas there.
No, I don't think so. When my father lived there, of course, it was, you know, horse and buggy. And his family was Tex-Mex, so my father spoke Spanish until he was a teenager. And he told me that he learned English on a tour bus. One of the horn players was taught English and taught him English. But Berry Durham is my father's grandfather, and he was from Mississippi, and his father was from Kentucky. So when Berry Durham came to San Marcos, it had just been established, not much earlier than that. And mm-hmm. and Berry Durham actually founded one of the first African-American schools. Although Berry Durham was Irish, he married a Native American, and he founded one of the first African-American schools in San Marcos, which
wow.
it's not there anymore, but it was well documented because there was an architectural company that wanted to build something there, and they had to do a whole study on that area to find out if there were artifacts buried, and this history of the school came up.
And that was Eddie's grandfather?
That was his grandfather, Berry Durham.
Wow. And then, and what year was Eddie born?
Well, that's a discrepancy as well. He says he was born in 1909, but it's listed as 1906 everywhere because he said when the census was done, his eldest brother changed his birth year to help him to avoid going into the war, to being drafted. So on record, it says 1906, but my father says he was born in 1909, but when you kind of do the math of all the siblings, 1909 and 1906 don't really work out. But most people may know, I'm sure they do know, that African Americans didn't have birth certificates for a long time. So, you know, if the information is not meticulously passed down, then you really, really don't know for sure. But
gotcha.
The centennial was celebrated in 1906. I'm sorry, in 2006.
In 2006, the 100th anniversary.
Yes.
So, very interesting background. So, some Irish ancestry, some Native American ancestry, some Afro-American, African-American ancestry, and he grew up speaking Spanish.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Which is just, I don't know how many jazz musicians who had such an impact, who grew up in the United States, grew up speaking Spanish. I mean, we certainly have all of our Afro-Cuban artists, and we understand mm-hmm. that they were Spanish. So Eddie was in a Tex-Mex community, and we typically don't think of the Tex-Mex community as producing great jazz musicians, but here's a case where they mm-hmm. produced one of the most important, as we're going to mm-hmm. see when we get into the detail.
Or Native American, we don't think of as well.
Right. And yet, this is interesting. I've done a little study on this, and it's amazing how many jazz musicians actually have some Native American ancestry. It's quite surprising. Mm-hmm. Charlie mm-hmm. Parker, Dizzy mm-hmm. Gillespie, Ornette Coleman. Mm-hmm. There's a lot. But mm-hmm. interesting in this case is Eddie was raised in sort of a Native way. In other words, he had as a child, his hair was worn long and braided. Can you tell
mm-hmm.
us a little about that?
Mm-hmm. I mean, he says that his mother kept it in plaits. He had long braids, and he had some relatives on a reservation because he mentioned hanging out with a cousin on a reservation. And then later in life, when he and my mother divorced, my two youngest siblings were still underage and had to finish school, and my father took them to Goshen, New York, to live with this relative that he grew up with, Roland Gillis, who he said lived on the reservation, was a relative of his that he used to hang out with. So he was very, very connected to his Native American heritage. And he also had a lot of remedies when we were children, when we were sick, unconventional remedies that for us when we got sick that, you know, I'm going to only divulge in the book. But, yeah, you know, of course, when we were kids, we didn't realize that. But later on in life, I realized, oh, okay. That's, you know, he also did things like we had dogs, and he would train the dogs to, you know, we had a house, and they would go in the backyard, and they would do their business, but they would dig a hole and bury it.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a dog that would go to the store and come back with the newspaper. So a lot of those things I think he learned from the circus.
He trained the dog to go get the newspaper?
Yeah, he trained the dog to go get the newspaper. Yeah, I mean, I didn't realize all of this until later, you know, that this was not a usual thing. But, yeah, he had a lot of – he was really good in pretty much all the areas that he – that you would function in life. I mean, he was a really good cook, but he wasn't just a cook. He was a showman. He would flip the pancakes up in the air and, you know, it was
– I hear he was also a really good carpenter, too.
Oh, yeah, he did everything around the house. There was never, ever a contractor in our house. We had a fire, and my father pretty much built the house back himself. He, you know, he did all the painting, all the woodwork, all the everything. He was really good. He would put up a pool in the backyard, like a four-foot pool every summer, and take it down every summer. It had, like, panels that went around, and you would put, you know, he put the liner inside, and then we'd fill it up, and then he taught us how to siphon the water out at the end of the season, and, you know, he put up swings, and we would swing on the swings and jump in the water. So, yeah, everything he built, he would make it himself, and he would put it up, and it would never fall down, put it that way.
That's good. And he was a real frontier kid. He grew up riding horses and hunting rattlesnakes.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. His eldest brother, Joe Jr., first of all, his father was a Bronco. So, you know, riding horses, that was like the back of their hands. And then, of course, they're in Texas, and it was in the Southwest, and it was in the early 1900s. Everybody had guns, and they all knew how to use them. But so he said, you know, they knew how to go and hunt rattlesnakes for the rattles and sell the rattles. And his brother was also was the musical director for Teddy Roosevelt's homecoming band, the Rough Riders. And, you know, of course, in the circus, they had all these trick riders who could do anything on a horse, or halfway on a horse, or falling off a horse, or standing on a horse, and shooting, you know, sharpshooters from the moving horse. So he was exposed to all of that. Yeah, he speaks about going and hunting rattlesnakes and how to do it, and how many rattles are on, how you can tell the age of a rattlesnake from how many rattles there are, and how to not get bit when you're hunting them, and all kinds of great childhood stories for us.
Wow. and this is all, hopefully all this is going to be in your book.
Oh, yeah. Yes, it is. Mm-hmm.
Good. Now, speaking of one thing that you said, I want to make sure everybody caught this because it's really significant. His older brother, who was a lot older than him,
Joseph Durham Jr. Yeah, he had to be at least 10 years older than him, at least.
He was, in case people missed that, he was the music director of Teddy Roosevelt's Rough Riders.
Yes.
So I imagine he went to Cuba to fight.
No, he didn't. He wasn't in the Rough Riders. He was the musical director of the homecoming band for the Rough Riders.
Oh, I gotcha. Gotcha. Mm-hmm. When they toured around.
Right, when they came back to Texas, and he learned to notate music, and he taught all of the siblings how to notate music, and he taught them all the instruments. He played all the instruments, and he taught all of them all their instruments. So trombone and the banjo, my father learned from Joe Durham Jr.
How
in the early 20s. Mm-hmm.
Do we know how Eddie's brother learned so much music? That's incredible.
I have no idea. Mm-mm.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, because again, everybody, we're talking about a tiny town that's an hour by car, and there were no cars when Eddie was born.
No, there were no cars.
We're talking about maybe an all-day horse ride.
Well, even though his father was not only a Bronco, he was the town fiddler.
Oh, okay, that's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. He was a fiddler. I forget. In fact, mm-hmm. and this to tie this back to the rattlesnakes, his dad used to put rattlesnake rattles in the fiddle.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I don't know if you knew, I learned this from another source after learning about Eddie's father, that was a thing they did in Mississippi in the guitars. Mm-hmm. And so it's...
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, it's a Mississippi thing too. So
wow.
That really,
so then his father probably learned it from his father.
It's possible,
Jerry,
right?
Jerry Durham, who came from Mississippi. Yeah, possible. Mm-hmm.
Oh. So the father was a fiddler, town fiddler, and everyone's got to use their imagination here, right? There's no TV. There's no internet, of course.
No. No phones.
There's no radio. Oh, no phone, of course. There's no phone.
No airplanes.
No airplanes. No transistor radio. So when we talk about entertainment, the town fiddler was a big deal.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, the town fiddler and the circuses were the biggest deal. That was a big deal. No one missed the circus. That, you know, I mean, how else would you see exotic animals and, you know, people who had all these talents, you know?
Well, let's talk about that in a second, because that's very important. This circus element of Eddie's mm-hmm. life have had a big role. But let's talk a little bit more, if we could, about the fiddling. Now, I've read that Eddie went with his dad on some of these occasions and participated in the performance. Do you know anything about that, how that worked?
Yeah, he said that he and his brothers would go and shoot the rattlesnakes, get the rattles, and they'd put them in their father's fiddle. And that would make the sound loud with that wood. It would make it like an amplifier. But he said that they would take, you know, they would kind of play percussions with their hands, put it that way, you know, on something. I don't remember what it was.
They'd provide the rhythm section.
Yeah, the rhythm section with their hands.
So hat pins,
I think he said it was hat pins they would use.
Yeah, and I'm trying to visualize that. Like, did they bang the hat pins together? Did they, like, how? I read that part of it. You know, yeah, I know we can't ask now, but somehow he was involved in providing the percussion to accompany his dad's playing. Do you have any idea how young he was when he was doing that? Was that something that he did from the early age?
Yeah, he would have definitely been in his probably preteens, or maybe even before that.
Okay.
More than likely before that. I'm going to guess around 10 years old, something like that.
Gotcha. So as a little kid, he was already a musical performer, and his dad was the fiddler in town. And then one of the things that we...
And already trying to amplify something.
Right. That's right. This is going to be very... And people might be listening to this story and going, well, what does all this have to do with jazz? And I'm just going to say, folks, hang on. When we get to the jazz part of this, you're not going to believe all the things that Eddie Durham did. But I just want to set the stage for where he came from and his background, because that's, to me, an equally fascinating part of the story. So he's living in this tiny village, you know, kind of, for us New Yorkers, we would say in the middle of nowhere, you know? And this is way back before all these modern entertainment things that were going on. His dad was the fiddler. He participated in the shows. One last thing that I want to share with everybody, too, is he was a good rider, mm-hmm. right? I mean, he was a completely capable horseman.
Oh, absolutely. So, for instance, his father would go out to neighboring people and ask them, did they have a horse he could break for them? And the father would go catch the horse. He'd tell them, give me a week. He'd break the horse and catch the horse, break the horse, bring him in. And my father said he never saw his father get thrown. He said his father rode in some rodeos, not racing, but he was a jockey with the trotters and the paces, like with a two-wheel carriage behind him.
Yeah, like in Goshen, right? Goshen's the center.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Goshen's the center of that kind of racing, and it started there.
Right, yeah. So,
okay.
I mean, I would imagine, you know, I mean, he took us as kids to learn to ride horses. Me and my siblings, we all ride. We can all ride. You know, we didn't know why, but we used to go up to these ranches and stuff, and we would ride. And yeah.
Even though you grew up in New York City, he made sure that you knew how to ride a horse.
Right. He knew. Yeah, he sure did. And because he always told us, he says, New York is going to become a place for the rich and the homeless. You need to know how to ride a horse.
Wow.
One has to do with the other, but.
Wow. How did he? Well, he was a visionary, too, in addition to everything else.
I guess.
He sure hit the direction New York's going in. Wow. Gosh, I wish I could have met him. I'll tell you, he sounds like the most fascinating man who ever lived. Honestly, the more I hear about him, the more amazed I am about him. So everyone, I hope, is forming this picture of, you know, if we're looking at an all-American guy, I mean, he's got every element of America in him, plus he's a cowboy, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's got it all. And Now let's talk about the circus culture. And again, everybody's got to remember there's no TV. There's no, maybe there's some primitive movies, but movies are rare. There's no anything. So if there's going to be entertainment, it's going to be a live thing. So tell us about the circus culture that's going on in his early years.
Well, the circus, I never realized how important it was to African Americans. I mean, it was very important to culture because, like you said, there was no other communication, no electronic means of communication. So touring shows, whether it was minstrels or marching bands or circuses, was very, very, was the entertainment, you know. So if the circus came once a year, that was the big event, you know, of the town, and they waited for it till the next year. But it was also a conduit for African Americans who were, you know, segregated somewhat at that time still, I mean, from bands at least. But in the circus, they would have a white band and a black band, you know, Native American performers. They would have performers sometimes from all over the world. I mean, that 101, the first circus he was in was Doug Morgan's dramatic show. Mm-hmm. And then the second one was the 101 Wild Ranch Circus in Oklahoma. Doug Morgan was in Texas. But the 101 was a very big, very, very big, bigger than Barnum and Bailey, actually, at the time. And so this was way to socialize with interracially.
Uh-huh.
And so my father, you know, because musicians, I think really from the beginning of time, didn't have that same kind of prejudice within them. Mm-hmm. It was like you could either play or you couldn't play, you know.
Exactly.
They didn't really, you know. So that was... So the music itself was a world unto itself, but then the circus put it all together, you know. And back then, the circus was, you know, kind of somewhat seen as almost a freak show, so nobody cared that they interacted interracially, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The surface of the circus was sort of like the freak show, you know, but then the music bands at the end was the highlight of the circuses. So after the circus performance during the day, my father said at night they would all get together and kind of jam in these secret places. And, you know, he would give them stuff to, he would write, just practice arranging on them, and they would be glad to play it, and they would all play it. And that's how he learned how to arrange, because there's a lot of brass in the circus.
Mm-hmm.
So he learned six-part harmony in the circus. He didn't even know what it was. You know, then he tried, his brother sent him to a school in Chicago later on, and they were teaching, I think he said, four-part harmony and five-part harmony or something like that. And he says, well, you know, there was nothing there they could teach him because he already knew six-part harmony. So he probably should have took the professor's job. He would have made more money. But I'm sure, as an African-American, they wouldn't have allowed that either.
Yeah. So his brother sent him all the way to Chicago to study.
Yeah, he did. He sent him, I don't remember the name of it, but Coleman Hawkins went to the same school.
Oh,
there.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay,
Childs,
wow.
All that stuff.
Maybe we'll look that up sometime, because that's interesting to know that that was a school like that. So he did join the 101 Circus.
Yes, him and all his brothers joined the 101 Wild Ranch Circus. His brothers. It was the Durham Brothers Orchestra. In high school, they were the Durham Brothers Orchestra. They were all together. And then they started together doing minstrel shows and the circuses. And then Edgar Battle was a childhood friend, and and somehow the name of the band got changed to the Edgar Battles Dixie Ramblers, but it's the same personnel. It's all my father's brothers and cousins and Battles and an outside drummer.
And remember, this is the era of there's no DJs, so if there's going to be music, people have to show up with instruments and play it. And an orchestra like that in San Marcos would have been, you know, a really important part of the community, because people like to dance and get together, and you have to have musicians for that. So there was that opportunity to learn the music. So somehow he got in through, probably with his brother's guidance, and it would be great to somehow figure out how his brother learned so much music. But clearly, you know, his brother was a very gifted and very accomplished musician. So having for Eddie to have that kind of a guy as an older brother was probably a big, big boost. And it sounds like his older brother looked out for him too, you know, sending him to school in Chicago and all that. So the circus was a big part of his training too, being on the road and playing. And then let's talk about this. He was writing, and my understanding is he was the first person to write six parts for jazz.
Looking at some notes, and the school was called the U.S. School of Music in Chicago, and it was around 1922.
Now, let me ask you a question about that, and I don't want to throw you off, but I know something about that school. It was a mail-order school. It would send you lessons by mail. In everything, in every instrument, they had a course. In every instrument, they had a course in arranging, and it was based originally out of Chicago. So I'm wondering, it's possible that either he went to the live school, or do you know for sure that he actually went to Chicago? I'm just curious about that.
He says, Joe Jr., my brother, put me in a trade school called the U.S. School of Music in Chicago, where I stayed a year or two.
Oh, wow.
He went to Chicago with the Ranch Circus in 1922.
Okay.
So that's how he was in. And he saw King Oliver and Louis Armstrong when he was there. And he said he was living with his friend, a friend of his brother's, a Dr. Dorsey, who owned the drugstore. And I worked at Starsky Bakery. It was German owned. He says, and you'd work your way through it. At the school, I learned a little bit more about dynamics and the correct wording, but in Latin terms like tempo and accelerando. But they couldn't offer me much more than a foundation. Now, I do know, now that you mentioned that, his brother, Joe Jr., received music by mail. That's how he learned music. It was by mail.
So maybe it was
the same school.
So that clears it up. So is Joe Jr., you say?
Yes.
Joe Jr. managed to learn a lot of his music by mail, which is an amazing feat all by itself. But he actually sent Eddie all the way to Chicago, and Eddie was there, and he saw King Oliver and Louis Armstrong. Oh my goodness! Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
Well, he went there with the circus. Yeah. But his brother recommended that he go to the school while he was there.
Yeah.
So he says Edgar Battle was with him at that time.
All right, so I think we've done a good job of laying the foundation of Eddie's background, and I think it's important because I just think this is the most all-American story, honestly, ever told. I just feel that, but now we're going to get into the jazz part of this, and everybody, buckle your seatbelts. If you don't know the story of Eddie Durham, you're going to be amazed at how much he contributed to the development of jazz and his important role in jazz history. And I hope you'll tell everybody you know about it, because this is a big hole in our understanding of our history, and we've got to fill it in. We have to give credit where credit's due. So where do we start? There's so many things that Eddie contributed to jazz. Where would you begin to fill people in on all this?
Well, first I'll let everyone know that Herschel Evans was his cousin. So, you know, they were in Basie. Well, Herschel was with him in the Durham Brothers Orchestra. He was also in the circuses with him and the minstrels and stuff. But, you know, it really all started with the circus. The arranging started with the circus. And being able to read and write music really gave him a leg up on everybody pretty much, because there weren't too many African-Americans doing all of that. They could play, but they couldn't read. They couldn't write. They couldn't do some of these things that my father could do. And, you know, his brother, Joe Jr., and his father had to be extremely good musicians, you know. And actually, there are recordings of Joe Jr., so those are around. That's in the book,
okay.
Yeah. Actually, all of his brothers and his cousins are on recording, so I list them, you know. After Doug Morgan's dramatic show, and Doug Morgan was one of the first people to buy my father a real guitar, and the Miller brothers, then came Mamie Smith's 7-Eleven show that he was in, and then he was with Jesse Stone, and Jesse Stone was one of my father's mentors. Now, as much as my father wrote, he said that Jesse Stone could slap music on the paper, and he was glad to play it. So, and you know, Jesse Stone ended up marrying one of the International Sweethearts of Rhythm. She played trombone, I believe, as well. He also hung out a lot with Art Tatum, and because my father also played piano. He actually wrote on piano. So at home, wow. Yeah, we never saw him really playing the trombone and the guitar at home. He was usually on the piano.
Wow, didn't realize that.
Yeah, and he attributed all the piano playing he learned from Art Tatum.
Wow.
Which is amazing in itself. And he, you know, if he was on the road and he was in Art Tatum's town, he would stay with Art Tatum. And, you know, Art Tatum was blind, was maybe blind or partially blind. I'm not
yeah,
sure.
He was definitely legally blind. Yeah, very impressive visually.
Mm-hmm. And so Art Tatum was another one of his mentors. Then comes the Oklahoma Blue Devils Orchestra, which was really the start of it all professionally. So the 101 Ranch Circus was in Oklahoma as well. And
okay.
So, yeah, the Oklahoma Blue Devils
did not record with them. He as a performer, he didn't record with them.
Mm-mm.
I think he wrote for them, though, yeah? And arranged for them?
He would have arranged for them, but he didn't record with them. But the Oklahoma Blue Devils had a battle of bands with Benny Moten's band in Kansas City. And
mm-hmm.
not long after that, he left and went to the Blue Devils. I mean, he went to Benny Moten's band.
Gotcha. And for people that don't know this history, it might be hard to imagine because we're so biased. We think, you know, New York is it, you know, and, you know, maybe Chicago and New Orleans and, but we just cannot fully appreciate the level of musicianship and the love of music that was going on in Oklahoma, in Texas, in the Southwest.
Mm-hmm.
It was the level was very, very high, as
mm-hmm.
high as it gets.
Right.
And then because of a quirk in history, Kansas City was run by this guy Pendergast, and he was very friendly to the entertainment industry. So,
yes. Mm-hmm.
Right. During the Depression. So, you know, while other parts of the country were you know,
suffering.
Kind of struggling,
mm-hmm.
Kansas
mm-hmm.
City was boomtown. I've
mm-hmm.
read accounts. Mary Lou Williams, the great
mm-hmm.
pianist, she would talk about, you know, the music was all day and all night and it never
right.
stopped. And
mm-hmm.
you could go to 20, 30, 40, 50 clubs in one night. It was
mm-hmm.
might have possibly been the greatest explosion of jazz on any place, any time in the whole history of the music, including New York City.
Right.
So when Eddie ended up in Kansas City with Benny
mm-hmm.
Moten, that was a big deal.
Right. Because even though the Blue Devils won the Battle of the Bands, you know, Benny Moten had a working relationship with Tom Pendergast. And he, like you said, kept everybody working. And, you know, when you talk to my father about the Great Depression, he literally will say to you, what Great Depression?
Yeah, it was uneven.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, you know, in Kansas City, it was definitely no depression there.
Mm-hmm.
And the Blue Devils, I believe, I might have this wrong, but, you know, again, it's, you know, it's an art, but it's also a business. It's show business.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe
mm-hmm.
they just had some business problems. Had nothing to do with their
mm-hmm.
the creativity or the talent
yeah.
or the seriousness of the musicians. It's just sometimes you
right.
can't make it go. But Benny
mm-hmm.
Moten had that good gig in Kansas City, and so Eddie moved there.
Mm-hmm.
What did he do with the Benny Moten band?
Well, now he started recording. He recorded with the Benny Moten Orchestra 1929 to 1932. He was the arranger. He was the composer. Once he came in the band, no one else wrote or arranged for that band while he was there. So,
okay.
And then everybody else from the Blue Devils left and came over there as well, you know. That was in 1929. So now with that band, he wrote Lafayette. He arranged Prince of Wales, Toby. There's just a whole roster of music. Some of the songs that he recorded with them was Everyday Blues and I Wish I Could Be Blue, You Made Me Happy, Professor Hot Stuff. But this is still a lot of 2/4 stomp stuff
mm-hmm.
and Moten Swing, actually. Vince Giordano's band plays some of this stuff today.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah, he does this era. He also recorded... So now he's recording on trombone and guitar with this band. And then Jones Law's Blues and Bandbox Shuffle, which he didn't write, he plays some of the first single-line solos on guitar on a metal body type guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are some of the first recordings of soloing on a guitar, basically, in a kind of amplified style.
Maybe this is a time to focus on this. So, you know, the fact that he was arranging from Benny Moten is already an amazing, huge thing, because that Benny Moten band was so important to jazz's development. Mm-hmm. But Eddie was also the pioneer of the, would we say, the electric guitar in jazz, or how would we describe it?
Well, amplified and electric, because the amplified guitar was showcased on Hitting the Bottle with Jimmy Lunsford, and then the electric guitar was showcased in the John Hammond session. John Hammond produced the Kansas City Five sessions in 1938, and those were some of the first electric guitar recordings. And John Hammond produced that session to showcase the electric guitar. So Count Basie's not in those sessions. And in fact, the first four recordings, Lester Young's not even on them, even though now they're called the Lester Young sessions. But they were originally Eddie Durbin, his bass four. But the amplified guitar was hitting the bottle. My father didn't write that, but it was recorded with the Jimmy Lunsford Orchestra. So Jimmy Lunsford was fascinated with the guitar, as well as with the electrifying of the guitar, as well as John Hammond, and the two of them helped showcase my father on it.
And your father, you know, developed a lot of the technology that he used, right? I mean, there was no store to go to buy this
stuff. Right, yeah, exactly. Yep. He would make his own contraptions. He made his own amplifier. He actually put a hanger on one of the guitars to make it, we call it a whammy bar now. And, you know, I just say, you know, well, he should have trademarked any one of those things.
Oh, yeah.
Any one of them, okay, would have made my life much easier. But
yeah, oh, my goodness.
Much easier.
Wow.
Yeah.
I hadn't even thought of that dimension. He not only invented the style, but all the a lot of the technical things he invented.
Mm-hmm.
And let's talk a little bit about Charlie Christian, because a lot of people say, oh, Charlie Christian, you know, got all that started. But that's not exactly accurate. It was really Eddie that started it, and Charlie learned from Eddie. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So my father met Charlie Christian in, I believe it was Oklahoma City. Now, you know, this story goes back and forth about whether it did or did not. So I just want to make it clear that my book is based on the things my father told me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm quoting, you know, everything he says. Some stuff, of course, I get from the books and whatnot. But it's clear to me that at some point him and Charlie Christian met, and Charlie Christian took some lessons from him. Larry Lucy told me it was so. And there's quite a few other people that document that. The other thing is that you have to know my father to know that he wasn't a liar. Like, he wouldn't just make stuff up or put himself in something that he didn't do. He was very mild-mannered. He never yelled. He was always even-toned, which is, you know, kind of hard to believe to be raised by somebody like that. But, you know, anybody who knows him will tell you that. So when he says he did it, he did it. Now, his dates might be off. I have found that quite a bit that his dates are off, like his memory wasn't, but only by a year or two. But yes, he did meet with Charlie Christian. Charlie took some lessons from him. And the way that I know, other than all of what I just said, that is true, is because my father only played downstrokes on the guitar. He did not play upstrokes. And when Charlie first started playing, he only played downstrokes.
Oh, okay.
And then the famous song Swing to Bop that Charlie put out, I mean, if you really listen to it, it's Topsy. It's the song Topsy. So I'm not trying to take anything away from Charlie Christian, but he did get a couple of lessons from my father on the guitar.
It's definitely not the point, you know, to take away from Charlie Christian. It's just to say, hey, there was somebody before Charlie Christian who was doing
right,
this.
Right, absolutely, yeah.
That's all we're saying here. And it's important that we know who that was. Now, so that's the part of the guitar story, and it's even a bigger story, but for the sake of time, let's now talk about the role that your father had in Lester Young's career. And this is something everyone knows Lester Young for good reason, and everyone realizes Lester was one of the most important stylists in the music ever. So it's going to be interesting now to learn the role that Eddie played in helping Lester Young find his footing as a working musician.
Right. So you know that Lester Young and Herschel Evans had a working relationship, or people would call it a rivalry, in mm-hmm. Count Basie's band. Now, from what I know, neither one of them could read music, but they were excellent players. You know, they were the dueling tenors, as you would call them, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a really close relationship with Lester and with Herschel, of course. He grew up with Herschel. And I don't really know a lot about him and Lester Young, except that the way other people view Lester Young is not really the way my father viewed Lester Young. My father viewed Lester Young as a genius, and he said he could play something on the piano and Lester could duplicate it right immediately on the horn.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't, you know, but that's how you had to teach him. You couldn't write it out. He couldn't read it, but
gotcha.
He would get it right away, and that he was amazed at that. And so my father said that, you know, they would tour, and people would come up to my father after the show and, you know, one and say hi and talk, chit-chat a little bit, and then they'd get to the point, well, you think you could introduce me to Lester? And he would always be, you know, chuckle at that, because he said he would always think to himself, well, what is the big deal about Lester Young? Because he looks at things from a composing standpoint, from reading standpoint, you know, and this was a person that he helped. So he mentored a lot of people, but it's not common knowledge, you
mm-hmm.
know, or you have to discern it out of your readings. Well, okay, yeah, he was playing all this great stuff, and Eddie was writing it all, but he couldn't read. So how did that happen? You know, Count Basie couldn't read or write music. So how did that happen? You know, Herschel couldn't read or write music. So how did that happen?
Yeah.
So every time you find these people who are on these pedestals as band leaders, and they weren't before my father got there, and you look at the string of band leaders that he was with, and that it happened every time he got in the band, you know, you have to discern that, you know, oh, okay,
right.
What's Eddie doing? Because he's writing for them. Once he gets there, nobody else is writing, except I think the exception was Lunsford, where Cy Oliver was there. But Cy Oliver didn't know six-part harmony. My father taught him that. So there was a lot of people that he helped mentor. But the funny thing is, when they write their books, they never mention him.
Yeah, that's the showbiz part of things, unfortunately,
mm-hmm.
sometimes. But, you know, they say, mm-hmm. there's an old saying, if it happens once, it's a happenstance. If it happens twice, it's
mm-hmm.
coincidence. If it happens three times, you got to start questioning what's going on. Now, the story I heard about Lester Young, and this is really important. Lester had some commercial problems, showbiz problems, because he played in a particular register. That's what made him unique. He didn't do the normal tenor saxophone thing, and that's why we love him. But
mm-hmm.
it was hard for him to fit in with groups because they
mm-hmm.
wanted him in the zone, and he didn't
right.
want to be in the zone. But tell us, and now my understanding is that Eddie wrote the arrangements in such a way that Lester could stay in his register and fit in with the rest of the band. And that was a big part of helping Lester just get a foothold, a stable foothold in the music business.
Well, I wouldn't just attribute that only to Lester. He did that for everybody that he wrote for. He wrote
okay.
parts for each person to fit in, for the horns, basically, you know, to fit in.
Gotcha.
To whatever situation, and that's what made, I mean, because you have to remember that not long before my father started to do this type of arranging, bands didn't hire arrangers. They
okay.
just played, and then they became a unit, and then they recorded. But because Benny Moten became the standard, and, you know, that band pretty much just changed the name to Count Basie's Orchestra, right? And then Count
mm-hmm.
Basie's Orchestra became the standard for swing music, you know, and the band leaders who did figure it out, and of course John Hammond already knew that Eddie Durham was the key, you know, would hire my father to come and make their band marketable. So he
mm-hmm.
would come into the band, so the only difference would be the arranging. So, for instance, you know, he came into the Glenn Miller Orchestra, and arranged In the Mood. In the Mood was a song that was around forever. It was never a hit. It was just mundane melody somewhere. And when my father arranged the song and put all the pieces together and who should play what, it's the most famous song in history. When he came into, who else would be another good example? I mean, Lunsford was already a working orchestra, and Cy Oliver was a great writer and arranger, but they weren't doing six-part harmony, and they also weren't doing, well, they were already kind of doing the showmanship, but my father taught the Basie Band and the Glenn Miller Orchestra the showmanship of the horns. When you see the horns going back and forth, that's my father's signature.
Oh,
that came
no
from
kidding.
The circus. That came from the circus
about,
as well.
I was just about to say, where would he have learned that? He would have mastered mm-hmm. that circus.
In
wow.
the circus. So,
wow.
So he would write for each person to mm-hmm. fit in that particular, the sound of that band. And mm-hmm. a lot of times, like if you really follow his discography, he did a lot of the same songs over and over, but for different bands, you know.
Okay.
And sometimes he'd just give it a different name, especially if the band leader put their name on it. He'd do it again for another band and give it a different name, and then it would have his name on it. So he would make sure that he got the royalties at some point. Yeah. But, yeah, he did that for Lester. He did it for Herschel. He did it for, I mean, I can't even go through the list.
And this is a quality that Duke Ellington was famous for. He would get to know a musician, get to know that musician's sound, and then write so that musician would, and then blend all those unique personalities into a sound. And it sounds like that's exactly mm-hmm. what Eddie was doing with one band after another after another. Hey, since you brought up In the Mood, that arrangement, it's, you know, people debate, well, who did that arrangement? What was Eddie's take on how that came to be?
Well, he did the arrangement, but he didn't do the false endings, he says. He was not involved. They added that in later.
Ah.
But he was with Glenn Miller. I have to look some notes up on that one. He did arrangements for Glenn Miller, Tuxedo. Well, another dispute is Tuxedo Junction. But he did Wham! He wrote Wham! Rebop Boom Bam for Glenn Miller. He wrote, let me get the list here.
But while you're doing that, I want to say something to everybody. So, you know, an arrangement is not carved in stone. It's not like somebody, well, sometimes it is. Someone writes and that's it. It never changes. But In the Mood, Topsy referred to the false ending. So there's a lot of things going on with that arrangement. And it sounds like Eddie said, well, I didn't have anything to do with that part of it. That was somebody mm-hmm. else's contribution. But I'm going to guess that the core arrangement came from Eddie.
Oh, he did all the other parts of that song was his. Okay, so he said that the president of the union came and told him about Glenn Miller, the Glenn Miller band over in Glen Island Casino, and that Glenn Miller said that he needed some of the stuff that my father had. And Glenn Miller actually put my father up in an apartment in New York because I think it was Count Basie who told him, well, if you don't keep him nearby, he'll run off with somebody else. And so he traveled with Glenn Miller quite a bit, even though if you read about Glenn Miller, you will barely find my father's name anywhere. But he wrote Slip Horn Jive for Glenn Miller, which he said a lot of horn players don't like to play because it's an acrobatic song. And he says that when they would have to do Slip Horn Jive, they would just say, oh, well, let's just shoot Eddie because they hated to play that song. But he really liked working with Glenn Miller. You know, he said that Jimmy Lunsford and Glenn Miller were really good businessmen in the business. Those were the two people that he really liked working for, except for Jimmy Lunsford didn't want to pay anybody any money, he says. So that's mm-hmm. what broke that band up. But here's some things about Miller. So In the Mood was originally Tar Paper Stomp in 1930, but it wasn't copyrighted then. And mm-hmm. then you probably know this already anyway.
No, tell our listeners, though. This is you know, this is such core history, and we need to know it.
Uh-huh. And it was first submitted to Artie Shaw and then Glenn Miller. And Shaw and Miller performed air check versions as In the Mood, but Miller recorded it in 1939. So that's how that came about. And I forgot the name of the person who copywrote it, but it says that he came from, my father came from his own band at the Oak Grove Casino into Glenn Miller's band in the summer of 39. And
okay.
His contract with Miller called for 2 arrangements a week, but he went in with St. Louis Blues, which, you know, the Stomp, that's my mm-hmm. father's arrangement as well. My father also said that the guys, the musicians in Glenn Miller's band would give him, I don't remember what it was, $1 or $2 a week each to convince Glenn Miller not to use a baritone sax because they didn't want to carry it. So he convinced him he didn't need it. He didn't need a baritone sax. So, and he said Glenn Miller was a big fan of the showmanship of the Lunsford Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, my father said, when he rehearsed In the Mood, he would go down to Manny's and buy the derbies and the hats. And he taught the brass section all the fans and ways. And he said he arranged Tuxedo Junction, although I know someone else claims to have done that. And Glen Island Special, he wrote, Wham, Rebop, Boom, Bam. But he said, Glenn Miller said that with Wham, he didn't want the horns jumping like that. He said that the guys was going to miss that and they ain't going to sound level, you know, with the dot-dee-dot. So, so my father said that he would have the trombone hit the low note and the trumpet hit the high note. And the two horns are making that because he was always worried that the horn playing up high and down and low and then up. So,
oh, I got you.
Glenn Miller was worried about that. So he didn't want the music no more than about a third apart. And he wanted everything to perfection. But that was okay because, you know, my father's charts were poop perfect, he would always say. Now, one thing that some people, that no one probably knows, is that my father was married at the time to a musician, a woman who played trombone, and a lot of times he would have her write the charts for Miller's orchestra, but Glenn Miller didn't know it.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Yeah, that's in the book. So when he met Marion Hutton, who sings Wham, Rebop, Boom, Bam, my father said he didn't think much of her singing because, you know, he said he was looking for Ella or Billie Holiday, but Glenn Miller convinced him that she was young and pretty and blonde and white and the kids would love her and that, you know, he was right. And I guess that's like the time now the music is starting to turn over to, well, you know, what it is, my father says, you can write anything to fit anybody's talent if you know how to arrange.
Mm-hmm.
So
interesting.
That's,
okay.
Mm-hmm. That was one of his first examples.
Yeah, so we've just to do a recap, because it's a lot. Among all the other things that Eddie did, he was with the legendary Blue Devils. He wrote the arrangements for Benny Moten, worked with Count Basie, was a mentor to Charlie Christian, and chronologically, historically, can't be denied, preceded Charlie Christian in what he did. He also did a lot of technical innovation in inventing a lot of the things that we now take for granted on the guitar. He helped many musicians, including Lester Young, by the arrangements he wrote. Because, you know, you can't just be a free-floating genius in the jazz world, especially in those days. You really had to fit in with the unit. And if you had trouble fitting in with the unit, you were going to have professional trouble. And Eddie, because of his great ear and his great arranging ability, was able to write so that everybody could shine, which is, you know, which helped make Lester's career. It's just, you know, it's just a fact of life, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
He worked with Glenn Miller and everybody, you know, a lot of people who don't know anything about jazz, they know In the Mood and they know Glenn Miller and they know all the showmanship of that band and all that came from Eddie. And all this goes back to San Marcos, Texas, riding the range, hunting rattlesnakes, going out with his dad and you know, at the fiddle dances, you know, working with his older brother, you know, that all that amazing history. So I
and
think
the
that this, and of course, very important. And you know, you emphasized this so much in this call, and I'm glad you did. It's a kind of a missing link in our understanding of the development of jazz, how important those circuses were. They gave musicians a chance to play. They gave arrangers an opportunity to learn how to arrange. And it turns out that some of the showmanship that showed up later in jazz actually can be traced back to the circus. And one of the guys that helped make that transfer from circus to big band jazz was Eddie Durham. So, I mean, if the question is not what did Eddie Durham do, but what did Eddie Durham not do?
He was
everywhere doing everything. So I think our listeners now appreciate why I was so excited about this call today, Hopsy, and why I'm really saying to everybody, you know, we're a jazz community, and, you know, we educate each other. And I really want everybody on this call to tell people about this interview, tell people about Eddie Durham. You know, it's going to be a project, but bit by bit, let's make sure that everybody that loves jazz knows the name Eddie Durham and knows what Eddie Durham did to help make this music that we all love. So, Topsy, we could talk all week or maybe all month about all the things your father did, but time only gives us an hour. But I know you're working on this book. We're all anxiously awaiting it to come out someday. Mm-hmm. I know, as all authors are, you're looking for a publisher. If anybody listening here knows a good publisher, be in touch with me and I'll be in touch with Topsy. This is an important, now, again, I'm going to say what I said at the front of this. This is not just an important jazz story. It's not just an important American music story. This is an important American story. This was a great, great man. And what I love is he came from deep from the heart of Texas, small town. His ancestry is, he had a bit of everything. He's a bit Irish. He's a bit Afro-American. He's a bit Native American. And he grew up speaking Spanish. I mean, my God, you know, that's as American as you can get, you know, that kind of a story.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's everybody have fun and excite and amaze our fellow jazz fans by letting them know the amazing story of Eddie Durham. Topsy, thank you for giving us this time, and thank you for being the historian on this important subject for us. We have to have this story in our jazz history. It's essential.
Great.
Yeah.
He also wrote, "I don't want to set the world on fire." So I'll leave you with that one.
And I'll say it again. There are very few people in history I wish I could have met. You know, I'm happy to read about them in the books. That's good enough. But father's an exception. I wish I could have met him. I really wish I could have met him. I feel a lot of affection.
Quite a bit of footage online, but I know it's not the same. But thank you very much, and I hope to speak with you again soon.
Thank you, Topsy.
And the website is durhamjazz.com, but, of course, this is Jazz on the Tube, and we want your support.
Oh, yeah, that's right, everybody. What's the website, Durham?
DurhamJazz.com. DurhamJazz.com. No relation to Kenny Durham, although I do know his family.
Okay. So if you want to follow Topsy's work and get even deeper into Eddie's work, DurhamJazz.com, and we'll put a link below.
Yes.
And as much as we covered in this hour, there's so much more to know, but at least we hit some of the highlights.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, take care.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please share it. That's how we grow. And remember to subscribe to jazzonthetube.com, the Internet's largest collection of free, streamable, classic jazz videos.